You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up on this week's Parish Council, Top Gear, Election Debates, Jeremy Vine, The Apple Watch, and The Television Review.
Well, hello everybody and welcome back to the Parish Council. It's just a little podcast, but it does come from the Rocking Vicar. I'm Magnus Shaw and hello, Space Boy, it's Terence Dackham.
Hello, Magnus Shaw.
Hello. Space Boy.
Hey, you know all these unpaid interns that we have working here?
Ten of them.
Yeah, there were 10 of them here this week. Well, not one of them has brought me a steak lunch. So I've punched each of them, all 10 of them, in the face.
Yes. But has that brought your steak lunch any quicker, has it?
No, but it's okay, you see, because I'm almost famous. You see, that's the thing. If someone off the Jeremy Kyle show goes berserk, then we describe them as the lowest of the low, a subclass, if you will. But if you live in Chipping Norton and your show brings in millions for the BBC, well, then, you see, Magnus Shaw, it's all just a bit of banter.
All bets are off then, yes. Anything goes.
He's a legend, Clarkson, you see, apparently.
He is. Legendary for something, that's sure.
Maybe you can't say that anymore because it's too politically correct.
Oh, yes, he's just saying it like it is, isn't he? He's just speaking his mind, and you can't do that in the current climate. It's you can't say what you want to say.
You just can't. In this politically correct world, it seems you can't go around manhandling and lamping people.
No.
It's political correctness gone mad.
Yeah, health and safety, that's what it is. It's the health and safety regime bearing down on us.
It seems from the overwhelming numbers signing Save Our Clarkson petitions that I am in a small minority, but I really dislike the premise of Top Gear. I've never seen a full episode, but the bits I have seen fill me with woe.
Yeah, rightfully so. Yes, it's awful. So it just plays to the baser instincts of, I was going to say men, but I increasingly see lady folk extolling the virtues of Top Gear and how much they love it. So maybe the baser instincts of human beings, but it just strikes me as an excuse for overgrown schoolboys to run amok and upset people and each other. I can only agree. There's nothing in it for me. I mean, I don't know anything about cars. Not that cars seems to be the principal subject matter anymore. But as somebody who doesn't drive a car, doesn't know anything about cars, and intensely dislikes anything that is labelled laddish, then it has all the boxes unticked for me.
Well, you see, it's all about the banter, and banter for me is all too often a euphemism for snarky, nasty barbs.
Yeah.
And I always think, rather than like gossip, nothing positive comes from banter. And it troubles me that so many people find the put-downs, racism, misogyny and bad manners of this programme quite as hilarious as they do. And apparently, as we were saying, you're supposed to react by saying, oh, it's all in fun, it's just a joke.
Much as I'm loath to agree with you, everything you say rings true for me so far. But it's an interesting situation, isn't it, now? The BBC. The BBC have managed to paint themselves into a corner now because they've got a totally no-win situation. They've got two choices, to let Clarkson go or to retain him. If they let him go, then he will immediately go flying over to the competitor channels and pick up a huge fee, I mean, greater than he's currently milking the BBC for. And I don't know what kind of stake he has in the formats, but he'll take something similar with him, and he may well take Hammond and May with him too, so the BBC will be left sobbing into their cocoa on that one. If they keep him, then everyone will point to them and say, you mugs, you are in the pocket of Jeremy Clarkson, and he tells you what to do. So they can't win on this one.
No, they can't. And it's so popular around the world as well, which is, again, a great mystery to me. But all three of them, their contracts are up in the next couple of months. So you're right. They could all three leg it over to Sky if they so wish.
Well, if I was had to hazard a guess, I would say that Clarkson will undergo some kind of nominal punishment, some nominal punitive action. He'll have to take half his fee for the first two episodes of the next season or something, and the BBC will try and prop that up as some kind of appropriate response.
Yes, and of course, one of the issues is, of course, that the fellow that was the other party in the fracas, which we, you know, we now have to call it a fracas.
Apparently, yes.
The other fellow, a producer from Top Gear, of course, to a degree, his livelihood revolves around the show continuing. So he may very well be delighted to get a shake of the hand and, oh, I'm terribly sorry, let me, and, you know, then in the Daily Mail we see pictures of them both having a steak dinner together.
Yeah. Yeah. Like Simon Cowell and Stevie Ritchie in a Harvester. Yeah.
But I, you know, like you, I just don't get it, and I can't help but wonder what sort of insane ego leads anyone to want to lamp their producer because some food wasn't available. It's just beyond my comprehension. But here's the thing, Magnus Short, 54 days to the UK general election.
Are you sure? Because they're still getting it wrong, aren't they? These the people to whom this is of the most consequence are continuing to get it wrong.
Last week.
I know you've got a countdown clock on a website.
I've got a countdown clock.
Please forward the link to Messrs. Farage, Clegg, Cameron, Miliband, Bennett, etc.
Well, 54 days to go, as I say, and all to play for. And for those unsure for whom to cast their vote, there's the joy of the televised election debates. Except my Mr. Cameron, I say, Mr. Cameron, doesn't seem to want to play along.
No.
Now, this week, Michael Grade, former chairman of the BBC and ITV, offered some support to Mr. Cameron's point of view. Lord Grade said, quote, "Who do the broadcasters think they are? Their behaviour over the election debates leads me to believe that they suddenly have grossly inflated and misguided ideas of their own importance." Which
just give us the name of the person saying that again, would you?
Lord Grey. Yes. Some may argue that that could apply to Lord Grey. But do you believe the walls of democracy come tumbling down if Mr. Cameron chooses to swerve the television lecterns?
No. Of course they don't. The root of democracy lies in the pencil and slip of paper behind that little curtained booth. that's where the meat and grist of this thing takes place. However, to not wish to engage your political opponents in a public arena, and you know, there's nothing more public, as Mr. Clarkson knows, than being on the telly, it does rather suggest that you are shying away from the democratic process. Of course, there can be no compulsion in these things, but why? What are we to infer from the reluctance to take part in televised debates, particularly when all the other politicians are quite keen to do so? Now, obviously, we know why they're keen to do so. It's because they want to tear a few shreds off Mr. Cameron. But if he really is to convince us that he's fully engaged with the democratic process, then he should be prepared to front up to his opponents. If his record is so strong and if he has such a manifestly rigorous plan for the future, then he should be prepared to put that to his opponents and to us on the TV. So I don't think that democracy will suffer, but I think his role in it will if he doesn't show up. And I genuinely hope that they empty podium him is a clumsy new phrase that's entered the lexicon, empty podium somebody. But that would be very damaging for him if there is a podium sitting there that says Cameron Conservative and it's empty.
The incumbent always has the most to lose in these situations.
Oh,
but there's a there's another point that came up from your Mr. Miliband that I just want to run past you. So the topic of the pre-election television debate resulted in some fierce exchanges at Prime Minister's Question Time this week, with Mr. Cameron calling Mr. Miliband despicable and weak, while Mr. Miliband called the Prime Minister a bully. And I think that's a tactic that his advisers clearly believe hits the target. So he likes to throw that in. I do feel that the focus groups, that hits home. But the most troubling aspect of this for me was your Mr. Miliband advising us this week that a government under his leadership would pass laws making it a criminal offence if a party leader failed to attend these television debates, giving us the prospect of police knocking down the door of Mr. Cameron or Boris or Theresa May at 4 o'clock in the morning and dragging them to the studios of Sky News in Iceland.
speak, goddamn you.
Yes, that's it, or you'll be up before the beak. And this, I mean, to me, this proposal sums up everything that the Labour Party get wrong, imposing their will on everybody else. It's the flaw at the heart of communism, socialism, and other sort of Maynard Keynes failures, from Marxism to state-directed movements all across the globe. Making it a criminal offence, that's ridiculous.
Of course it's ridiculous, because if you're compelled by law to attend a debate, you can stand there in silence. They can, you can do what you like to me, but you'll never get me to speak. You know, it's the old interrogation room in those old cop movies, isn't it? Of course, that is preposterous, absolutely preposterous. All Miliband needs to do is to say, if you have the record that you claim to have, then why not stand on that record and defend it? And that's sufficient to wound Mr. Cameron. The idea of forcing somebody by law to engage in a debate is, I agree, quite ludicrous.
Yeah, the overarching point for me as well is that these debates are just terrifying beauty contests for those taking part, because we're a democracy and we're not a president-led administration. So we don't vote for Mr. Cameron or Mr. Miliband,
that's right,
unless we actually live in their constituency.
No, that's absolutely true. But I mean, I guess it would be argued that they are there to represent the policies and manifestos of their parties. And that is what we are supposed to vote on come a general election.
Wait a minute, do we? We vote locally. So surely it's far more value to become involved locally. Go to your hustings, the meetings in your constituency, and question the local candidates.
Oh, yes, I agree. But I am in favour of the TV debates simply because our audience figures show that it does engage people. People do, I was going to say tune in, which is becoming an anachronism par excellence, isn't it? Because the idea that we tune our tellies is mad. But people do switch on these events. And
22 million time round, so you're right on that.
That kind of political engagement is particularly important these days when there is so little political engagement. And so if 10% of those people watching are persuaded to turn out to the polling booths who otherwise wouldn't have, then that's got to be a good thing. And we need to put the paddles on the democratic process in this country and shoot some voltage through it, because it's limp, to say the least, at the moment. And I think election debates do have a role to play in that.
I take your point, but personally I'd leave television to Clarkson, May and Hammond, and I'd rather go and see my local candidate debating
I'd like to see both, I will gladly watch all the debates, whether there's one or 17 of them. I'd probably watch the lot of them, because I am a bit of a political and current affairs anorak, so that I'm the kind of person who would, but I think I'm glad they're there, and it would be it would be an awful slip backwards if we didn't have them anymore. I think.
Well, I'm going to put you at the centre of a dilemma here.
Oh, please.
Sure. Yeah, what with your socialist principles and all that, right?
Yeah.
Because cuddly Jeremy Vine. Oh, Jeremy Vine. You know, he just wants a stroke. You know, cuddly Jeremy Vine. He's been in the news this week, the affable presenter of the daily Radio 2 Safe Music and Moanin' show, and equally cheery host of the television quiz show Eggheads. He's been in the Daily Mail because they've discovered that Jeremy Vine has been running his incoming fees through a limited company, Jelly Vine Productions, and this company has as one of its shareholders his 10-year-old daughter Martha. By ensuring he's paid through Jelly Vine Productions, the Daily Mail alleges that he will pay company tax of 23% or 24% instead of the standard PAYE rate of 40% or 45%. Now, is it fair play to bring his 10-year-old daughter's business expertise into this process, or should he stump up so we can employ some more nurses?
I think we obviously live now in an age of perception, and simply because anybody projecting the wrong perception is so rapidly picked up on and lambasted across the internet and elsewhere. So perception has never been more important than it is now. And I think it behoves everybody in public life, and that includes broadcasters. I think if you're a national broadcaster, you can, you know, safely say that you're in public life. But this goes stretches to politicians and leaders in the arts and other fields. Is just take a look at the way your affairs are arranged, and just, if you can, project how that may be perceived to the people whose approval you depend on. Because I'm just never cease to be amazed at how few people do that and come to the correct conclusions. Jeremy Vine has hosted untold debates, one of which is being hauled out for replay at the moment, but that's certainly not the only piece he's done on tax avoidance, tax evasion, tax planning, and the perception thereof. Indeed, I couldn't quote him verbatim, but I am absolutely certain I've heard him put to prominent people that their arrangements, their financial affairs, are perceived to be unfair, unhelpful, and dishonest. I'm sure he has put that to many a person. And this just displays all the symptoms of exactly that, of doing something that, albeit is completely legal and within all regulations, just looks really bad, simply because he has the opportunity to do it and millions of other people do not. And he earns an enormous, to most people, an enormous fee from the BBC for what he does. And I think almost everybody would say he should pay the appropriate taxation as if it was a PAYE salary. He shouldn't have the opportunity to divert funds hither and thither to pay a lower rate of tax on them to his advantage, particularly as that fee is paid out of the licence fee.
Well, I think he's got a real problem now, because imagine next week or the week after, some great scandal, parliamentary scandal comes out where yet another MP is found to be avoiding paying their tax, that they're right, running their tax issues through the HSBC branch in Geneva, yep, or whatever.
Indeed.
And then in between playing the Eagles Take It to the Limit and people ringing in moaning about people parking in mother and baby spaces,
yep,
in supermarket car parks,
yep,
he has to interview Nick Robinson about this very issue, and is it a resigning issue for this terrible Member of Parliament? That leaves him in an untenable position, doesn't it?
It does. I think it really does. I think it does cause that kind of problem for him. And you know, that just goes back to my point. Why did he not at any point think, I could do this, my accountant would set it all up for me, and I'm allowed to do this, but to be honest, it gives the wrong impression, particularly, yeah, as you rightly say, for somebody who needs to have that mantle of objectiveness whilst he's going about his job. Of all the shows on Radio 2, That is the one where the presenter needs to be have the moral high ground and appear to be particularly clean when they are taking the arguments to the great and the good. And it's not enough to say he's been badly advised, because that suggests he's completely pliant and sits there waiting to be told what to do. He's made some very bad decisions there, assuming this is all correct, that this is actually the state of his tax affairs.
Let's just assume it is for the sake of argument,
let's assume that it is. Then I can't imagine why it didn't cross his mind. He's a very, very intelligent man, that this would play extremely badly if and when it came out. And also, as an investigative journalist, he must have been pretty certain that it would come out. So, a fool. I mean, he's been a fool.
You'd think so, but let's just twist this round the other way. In the spirit of fairness, let's turn it round the other way, because when anyone, including me, gets up on their high horse about self-employed people paying taxes, let's just look at these questions. Three questions, I'm just going to ask you them all in a row. You don't have to answer each one. It's just to make a point. If you found a £10 note in a deserted car park, would you hand it in to a police station? We're looking at the moral code here. If the local authority forgot to claim a month's worth of council tax from your direct debit, would you ring them up and tell them? And finally, if you were going on holiday and the airline misread your ticket and put you in first class by mistake, would you own up and say, I shouldn't be here?
Well, in all but one of those instances, that is happenstance. That is something that has befallen you that you didn't plan or ask for. And so the question arises whether you take advantage of that good fortune, if you like. That is very difficult.
Well, but the moral position still remains the same. You're taking isn't yours.
No. I think there's a manifest difference between those instances that you've described.
Just and go with my £10
Now hear me out. That's the exception. The other two. I'm referring to the other two. There's a world of difference between taking advantage of happenstance, of good fortune that's befallen you, and actually making concerted plans to benefit yourself in a certain way. This didn't happen by accident to Jeremy Vine. He didn't accidentally find himself with a private services company through which to channel his money. He planned for that. He made that decision and took that time and effort to arrange things in that way. And even with the £10 in the car park, I mean, you're faced with that. That has happened to you, not by any of your own design. I do take your point, but I think there are shades of grey here.
Well, I'm not so sure there are. That's why I was getting a bit hoity-toity there, because if you take that £10 and you go and spend it down the pub, that could be a single parent who's got to go to the food bank because when they went to the police station and said, "Has anyone handed in a £10?" They say, "No, sorry, but you've spent it down the pub." it's possible.
It's entirely possible, but I think how you behave when faced with temptation is quite different from planning.
Well, it's just planning temptation. That's the only difference. It's still temptation.
Yeah, that's the difference that I'm shining the light on.
One is planned and one isn't. Yeah. I don't see any difference at all. You
would decline the accidental first class seat, would you?
Well, this is what I'm saying. I'm posing this for all of us and saying, when we get on our high horses and we're saying, "Oh, Jeremy Vine," as I'm agreeing with you, saying, it puts him in a dreadfully difficult
position.
Yeah,
my point is the one of.
But would we all do it? Wouldn't we all do it? Would we?
I absolutely, honestly, if I had Jeremy Vine's job, I wouldn't have arranged my affairs like that. Simply, not because I'm a paragon of virtue, far from it, but simply because I think if this comes out, I'm going to look a proper chump and it's going to turn my audience against me. It's just not worth it. The benefits in taxation is just not worth the grief if this is revealed. I think I would have the gumption to say, no, this is a mug's game and I'm just going to play it straight, and I can sleep well at night, just if for no other reason than I didn't want to lose the gig and I didn't want to lose my audience.
Okay, so, I mean, essentially what I think, in a way, we're both saying here is that everybody would probably try and save a few quid if they can, but if they believed that it would come out and it would be in the Daily Mail, then they wouldn't do it.
Oh, that's probably right, yes. Yes. I mean, my only point is that Vine has been foolish to allow himself to get cornered like this. I'm not really casting a moral aspersion on him. I am just saying professionally he's played a very bad hand here. And, you know, he will presumably reap the consequences, whatever they may be. Minimizing taxes, I agree, is something that we would all seek to do given the chance. I think the unfairness comes when people who are drawing large salaries from the public purse, which the license fee is, are also enjoying the chance to pay as little tax on it as possible. That strikes a bum note for most people.
It does. It doesn't feel right at all. And as I say, if he then soon has to conduct an interview on that subject, then awkward it shall be.
Yeah, indeed it will, yeah.
Yeah. Now, you've revealed to us in the past, Magnus Shaw.
God, what?
You've revealed to us in the past that you like to wear a wristwatch.
Oh, yeah, I do like a a nice watch. Yes, I do.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm wondering if I can persuade you to overcome your fear of wearable technology and ask you if you're considering buying the all-new Apple Watch. Launched this week, but released in the UK on April 24th, Apple are opening pop-up stores for Apple addicts to try the watches out. Now, your basic model starts at £299 English pounds,
right,
and you can pay as much as £13,500 for a special edition gold version. Which of these will you be buying, Magnus Shaw?
Oh, I haven't got a fear of wearable technology. My point about wearable technology is that it is for its own sake, and it doesn't enhance the convenience or the practical nature of the device, which has somehow been woven into a tank top or a sock. They just did it because they could, and that's the mistake with this wearable stuff is now they can do it, so they're going to do it. Nobody stopped to think, yeah, but does it enhance the device or does it detract from the device? I haven't seen up close one of these Apple watches, but A, if it stands several inches proud of one's wrist, it's not like
big block of wood.
Yeah, you remember those baby sized single serving baked bean tins of baked beans you used to get? You don't get them anymore, but you know the ones, don't you?
Yeah, I do.
So something like that, like strapped to your arm with like duct tape.
So you walk like leaning down
like
on
Liam
one
Gallagher,
side. Because
yeah, you walk like Liam Gallagher, yeah. then I can't see this being a big hit. But if it looks like a smashing, you know, tasty, nicely designed watch, then perhaps it's got a fighting chance. But how, I mean, this remains to be revealed, I guess, but how on earth are you going to carry out all the functions? It's tough enough on an iPhone sometimes to get to the subtleties of the thing you're trying to press your finger on, especially if you've got big pork sausage fingers like mine. How are you going to do it on the screen of a watch? I can't begin to imagine, but it has to enhance the experience of using the device, not just have been created because the ability to create it existed.
Well, there's another issue as well, Magnus Shaw, because on the Apple information page, we're told that we can expect to get 18 hours worth of battery life out of your Apple Watch.
Right.
So long as you don't use it very much. Normal use.
Already, that's stupid, isn't it? You can have 18 hours, but don't use it.
Don't use it very much. Normal use is considered 90 time checks, 90 notifications, 45 minutes of app use, and a 30-minute workout with music playback from your Apple Watch via Bluetooth.
Oh, well, I'm safe on that count.
Well, I thought it sounded just like your lifestyle, Magnus Shaw.
Exactly, yes, yes.
30-minute workout. But you see, this is the problem. So if you're going to be out for a long day, you better carry your Apple Watch charge around with you. Because can you just imagine the situation? I'm sitting with you having lunch, and I say, well, what's the time, Magnus Shaw? And you say, I don't no, my watch is on a charger.
Exactly, yeah. I was going to ask you where you plug the charger in, but perhaps you better not answer that.
Terrifying thought, yeah, no, isn't it? The body wear, yes.
It's probably not broadcastable. But yes, that is exactly the point, is that you can get 18 hours out. Well, you know, I can get a whole year's use out of my iPhone if I never switch it on. You can't. Here we go. It's not enhancing the experience, is it? It's narrowing the experience down to an enormous inconvenience. I'm sure it will have great appeal to tech nerds and maybe hipsters down your Shoreditch way, who can just casually lead across the counter in the artisan coffee shop. So that everybody can see they're wearing an iWatch, but beyond that, it sounds like a massive white elephant.
Well, let me tell you a couple of the things that you can do with it, and then we'll get your final and firm judgment on it. Because Apple Watch allows the user to the wearer to use iTunes, Siri, Apple Play, Mail, Facebook, and Twitter, and it receives all the notification your phone does. eBay is on the way. That app is coming very soon, as is City Mapper. Now, I thought this one might be useful for you, because what happens here is you've got City Mapper on your phone, and it buzzes on your wrist when your bus has reached your designated stop. It figures it out through GPS.
Oh, yeah.
So
well, can you see where you'd be?
Yes, but you've got to get the phone out of your pocket. Here, you're wearing it on your wrist, so you can place a bid on eBay just by touching your wrist, and you can update Twitter by banging a tiny, teeny, teeny little keyboard.
Yes, exactly. I just spoke about that. I mean, are you going to have a charger and one of these? I see these styluses now for people who don't.
Imagine.
Yeah.
Now here's the thing. Imagine you're coming down to London to see a bit of civilization, and you're on the train and you're kind of just sort of
you go. But anyway, yeah.
Snoozing away. And you think to yourself, I'm not used to this era London ways. These sophisticated ways down in that London. That's what you're thinking, you see.
Yeah, I'm not actually from Devon, you might have noticed.
Sophisticated
ways?
Ah, Demelzer.
That's the West Coast, you fool.
Oh, yeah. No, but imagine you're just pulling into King's Cross and you're thinking, is this where I alight? And your iPhone, your Apple Watch, sorry, not your iPhone, your Apple Watch will buzz to tell you by GPS, it'll say, you've got to get off here.
Oh, ye of little knowledge. St. Pancras is the end of the line. Therefore, the chances of me not noticing and not getting off are slim to none before the train terminates at St. Pancras and I just get off when it stops. In fact, I've once had to be woken up and asked to get off, so I didn't need an iWatch for that. The guard did the job for me.
Is that when you were sleeping rough?
Well, it's pretty rough sleeping on a train, but I'm getting the feeling
you won't be buying an Apple Watch, will you?
Hey, Apple, you know, the ball's in your court. Show me that it's an enhancement, it's going to improve my experience of Apple products rather than making it what it sounds like, which is using a tiny, tiny, tiny little iPhone that is doubly inconvenient because you can only use one hand because it's lashed to the other one. I remain to be convinced.
I was reading on the BBC today that the Chinese companies are already, you can actually already buy them. They're pumping out their own sort of almost but not quite versions of the Apple Watch.
Yeah, I remember they did that with the iPods. All the car boot sales were full of them, yeah.
You can get one for about £60.
Okay.
At the moment. So, but I don't know. My instinct is that we all may be wearing these Apple Watches in a year or so. I've just got this feeling that, maybe not for the things that we've said, but certainly that sort of the business of getting you round town, telling you when you're in the right road, instructing you to go left, right.
Do you remember? Actually, that might be handy whilst motorcycle.
Do you remember?
A show in the late 70s, mid 70s probably, called The Gemini Man.
No.
Starred Ben Murphy from Alias Smith and Jones.
Oh, yes, sir.
As a scientist stroke secret agent who'd been given a digital watch, and when he pressed it, he went invisible.
Oh, wow.
It went beep, and he went invisible. Now, the challenge to Apple. Then we'll buy one. Then we'll buy one. If we can be the Gemini man, press our digital watch, go invisible, then you're onto something.
Oh, that would just open up so many possibilities.
Get on YouTube and look up the Gemini man. What a great show! Yeah,
oh, that's marvelous. Now it's time for another in our award-winning series, in which Magnus Shaw tells us something that he calls, if you only do one thing this week, then make sure you jolly well do this. It's a musical choice this week, and before he tells us about it, here's a 60-second teaser of today's subject.
We close our eyes and fantasize to see what dreams become alive. Our creative energy runs through. When we connect our consciousness, make our love a guiding light, and I am in every part of you. Never feel that you're alone. Hold on tight and I'll be strong. In spite of all the things we've done, our love is all sacred.
So there you go. If you didn't quite recognise it, I'm sure you did. Erasure, brand new single. It's called Sacred. I was going to say a few weeks ago, but it must be a good 6 months ago. I actually interviewed Andy Bell when he was, he was preparing to release some solo stuff and do some solo shows. But he told us then that it wasn't the end of Erasure by any means. Erasure had plans to do a new album and some new material and some new shows. And here we are. We've arrived at that point now. He's back with Vince Clark, and a new album is in the offing. And this is the first single off it to sort of herald its release. Called Sacred, and I saw it on some stuff that was sent to me, new Erasure stuff was coming. I thought, well, you know, a long time since I paid any real close attention to Erasure, let's give it a go. Well, how pleased was I? I really think this is a tour de force, a return to form of Erasure. And had this been a release, you know, in the 80s and 90s when everybody was Erasure-tastic, then I think this would have been up there with some of their biggest hits. I think they've really, really found their metal again. And that little sparkle of magic that made them such a big pop band, you know, 20, 30 years ago, is back in full show, and I really, really like this single, and all I can do is commend it to you. We'll post links hither and thither and probably embed the video on the Rocking Vickers site, and you may even push the boat out and go and buy it, because I think this is Erasure at their very best, and I'm very glad to see them sounding so good after all this time.
Well, if you liked the sound of what you just heard there, this is Erasure's new single. It's Sacred. It's released on Mute Records on Monday, the 16th of March. And I don't know if you'll be getting this one, Magnus, but it includes a 9-track EP on CD for £7.
That sounds all right, doesn't it? I think that's a mini album for £7. If it's all as good as Sacred, then I'm all for it. And
it's all mixes of your Sacred.
Oh, I see. Ah, you know, no, I'm not so convinced now. The remixes tend to leave me cold. The thing with remixes is always that you think, yeah, that's quite good. It's not as good as the original song. I very, very rarely come across a remix that's as good or better than the original song. So maybe I'll just wait for the LP. That's what I need to do, I think.
Right. Now, a writer, actor and comedian turning his attention to mental health issues for a television show could be considered to be quite a dangerous exercise. Put a foot wrong and the feedback would be damning, to say the very least. Well, this week saw the first episode of Paul Whitehouse's Nurse on BBC Two, in which community nurse Liz, played by Esther Coles, meets eight characters, or service users, as you have to call them, during her working day, all eight of whom are played by Paul Whitehouse, wearing some extraordinary prosthetics designed by Neil Gorton. Did you warm to Nurse's bedside manner?
Yeah, to an extent. I, you're right. I think the real star of this show is the makeup. I think absolutely astonishing. We think how poor the prosthetic makeup used to be in Hollywood not that long ago. To see the creations on this is quite something. Of course, credit to Paul Whitehouse. Somebody has to inhabit that makeup and bring it to life as a convincing person. And he does manage to do that. It's nice to see him doing it not in the interests of an insurance company. That's for a change.
There were similarities, weren't there?
Yeah, he seems to. I mean, perhaps, I think if you do this kind of work, how many characters can you create and manage to make each one unique? There must be a finite number. And I thought some of them did remind me of the Aviva characters, which he quite perfectly entitled to sell those characters to Aviva. That's his job. But I did feel that at times we were seeing one of those, but not in any great ruinous way. I did warm to it. I thought there were perhaps too many characters, so it was hard to feel that you'd got to know any one of them in particular depth. I guess that's the reason that it goes to series, that you try and follow them. And I suppose Paul Whitehouse, being one of the big cheeses at the Fast show all those years ago, is quite used to those fast turnaround, quick cut comedy routines. Mm. But this had a very different texture to the Fast show. It'll be interesting to see how it develops, because what it all hinges on is how much we get to care about these people who are visited by the nurse, played by Esther Cole. If they can make us very quickly start to really care about them, then I think, you know, we will be making this appointment television. I don't think they've quite managed that in the first one, simply because there were so many characters.
Yes, I mean, Paul Whitehouse, of course, is absolute master of character acting and timing as well. That's one of the things that impressed me, because obviously you're drawn to the characters and the prosthetics and the hair and the makeup. But one thing that I really picked up on was his delivery of his lines. And one thing that Paul has gained over the years is the ability to take his time to deliver a line, and he'll sometimes just wait that extra second, and it sounds a bit sort of lovey, but it can really make the difference. The other thing I did want to mention is I thought Esther Coles was absolutely superb as the nurse, because that role, all too familiar to anyone who's ever had any recent contact with health services, would just recognise that sort of patronising nurse knows best kind of approach. I'm afraid,
and clearly wrestling with her own dilemmas between appointments, wasn't she?
Indeed. Yeah. Which again was a clever touch. For me, even though I knew about, you know, they were all Paul Whitehouse, it did take me a moment to recall that all of these characters are played by Paul Whitehouse. But in some ways, maybe you may think I'm overstating it here, but I thought some of these were little vignettes in the style of Alan Bennett's Talking Heads.
Yeah, I think there was a huge seam of Bennett's running through all of this. Yes, that sprang to my mind about halfway through. I thought this has a similar sort of pathos to an Alan Bennett piece, and that's not to pull down Bennett's work or to over elevate this, but I just think it had that same sort of emotional theme to it, that rather sad situations in life can also be touched with humor. And I think that's absolutely true. Anybody who's nursed somebody with a mental health difficulty or particularly a dementia problem will know that sometimes it's quite funny, because not because you're laughing at that person, but because situations like that throw up absurdities, because they are quite absurd situations, and I think they touched on that quite nicely. I would have you know, it's nitpicking, but I would have narrowed down the number of characters that we were exposed to. That's all I would say. And my favourite character, sorry, Mr. Whitehouse, because I thought your performances were terrific, but my favourite character was the black lady with the annoying Jewish neighbour who's played by Whitehouse. I mean, that is going to become quite funny, I think. I think we follow that series through. Certainly that situation, I would lay a tenner down and say that will become the funniest scenario that we're introduced to, because that's got the most potential for me. even in the three visits I think we made to that household, maybe two, it started to become funny because it was so annoying, and he started to become more and more intense in his annoying tropes, didn't he? Because when we first met him, we thought, oh, he's the lovely man who makes this woman's life worthwhile. And by the end, she was throwing crockery at him by the end, as we all felt like doing. So I can see that becoming very funny. But I thought she was superb. I thought the black woman was just fantastic and really tickled my ribs. So
She was very evangelical, but she was very keen to let us know that the coming into a house, it wasn't Jesus, it's the little man from next door. Called Morris.
Who is very keen to explain to us the difference between Judaism and Christianity at great length. And one wonders whether there wasn't a show in that on its own, to be perfectly honest, because it's one that sticks in my mind. Yeah. There might maybe in a show in that, but good stuff. Obviously, you know, talent involved all round, and I hope we just get to know the characters well enough to keep us in our seats when it's on. Yeah.
Just on Morrissey as well, he was very keen to tell us that, that there's nothing going on between them, him and the lady involved.
No, to the extent that it sounded like there was. I mean, that was the beauty of that script, wasn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, so, some very good lines. There was a lady whose house was overrun with cats, and Esther Coles, as the nurse, said, you know, well, have you had anything to eat today? And she said, oh, yes. She said, well, I can't see anything in the house other than cat food.
Yeah.
And she said, well, if it's good enough for my little darlings, it's good enough for me. And I'm afraid that could be all too realistic, I think,
I think that was true of a lot of the scenes or sketches, I suppose we could call them, that you did sort of feel, I'm sure this is somewhere to someone this is all happening. That I think it did manage to have that enough realism to make us think this is probably happening somewhere.
It's a new vein of comedy, I think, because it isn't, in fact, comedy. It's a kind of poignant portraits, and many of them are despair. So, you know, you wouldn't say it's a sort of knockabout comedy in the old-fashioned
sense. It's not knockabout,
sense,
but, I mean, the whole point, I think, you know, the word pathos is where comedy meets tragedy, isn't it? Is that in despair there is always an element of humour, not to laugh at anybody, but just at the ridiculous nature of the hand that life can deal you and anybody else, really.
I loved it. I found it absorbing and sympathetic and inclusive. And I do want to pay credit to, normally we talk about the writers and the directors, but we'll just pay credit. This was the prosthetics designer was Neil Gorton.
Amazing.
And Vanessa White did the hair and makeup on the show.
Yeah.
But this was Nurse. It was on BBC Two at 10 o'clock p.m. on Tuesday. It's available for 28 days on the BBC iPlayer. It was written by Paul Whitehouse and David Cummings, with additional material by Esther Coles. And it was directed by Ian Fitzgibbon.
Yeah. Very good indeed. That, I'm afraid, puts the silky cover back on the parish council for another week. What we're going to do now is go off, have a fracas with a producer, and, just see if anybody starts an online petition in our support. I'm sure they will. I'll be signing that in the millions. Many thanks, Terence.
Be seeing you.
Yeah, I'll be seeing you. But most of all to you, because you are our favourite listener. There's more over at therockingvicar.com. That's therockingvicar.com. And we're back in a week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar. Ooh, ah, ooh, ooh, ooh.
lightly thinking you're number one. Down a zero with their word, leaving for another one. Now you walk with your feet back on the ground. Down to the ground, down to the ground. Down to the ground, down to the ground. Walks through the crowd and takes your man. Sends you rushing to the mirror. Brush your eyebrows and say, there's more beauty in you than anyone. I remember who walked the warm sand beside you. More to your heel, let the waves come and rush in. She took the worry from your head, but then again, she put trouble in your heart instead. Then you fall. Down to the ground, down to the ground. You're no harder, still more crying when you're thinking of your mother's only son. Take to your bed, you sit this peace and sleep, but you dream of love instead. All the heartache you'll find can bring more pain than a best of song. Oh, when you fall, fall at my door.
You have been listening to a DAKM Media production.